Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the program host, guest, and participants, not necessarily those of KKRN, Community Radio, and the Acorn Community Enterprises, or the underwriters of this station. Welcome to Pearl on Politics, an American original for over 1 year. The sharpest minds, best sources, hardest talk. This is your host, Dr. David Pearl. Well, we are joined today in studio by KKRN's own Sarah Williford. Sarah, welcome to this program.
Hello, pleasure to be here.
Fantastic, fantastic. And we're joined out of studio via telephone connection with Dr. Andrew Thomas. Andrew, welcome.
Hello, David.
Fantastic, fantastic. And we're joined in studio by my co-hosts Craig Boyer and Pamela Spoto.
Hello.
Welcome.
And hello there, Dr. Pearl.
Welcome, welcome. And of course, our engineer is Shane Houchins. And Shane is not in studio currently, but we are wishing him hello as well. This program, we're going to go issue by issue, all the issues that matter. Issue one, the Al Franken meltdown. For those of you unaware, Al Franken is a Minnesota senator who has been accused of gross sexual impropriety. Who has taken, been observed in inappropriate poses with female U.S. soldiers. And he is a senator who has only yesterday agreed to resign from the Senate. Now, Al Franken is a Democrat. Al Franken is amongst the minority in the U.S. Senate. And Dr. Thomas, I'm wondering if you believe he should have stepped down for these allegations and what you think the implications of this event were.
Well, I think when you put it in context of the current political environment and the strategy used by his opponents, regardless of the allegations themselves. Now, keep in mind this flood of allegations we've been seeing recently against public figures are not actual civil lawsuits. They're not criminal allegations or have resulted in criminal prosecutions. It's merely, allegations regarding somebody's behavior that haven't risen to the level of a lawsuit or to the person being charged with a crime.
True.
I think that with Al Franken, from a political perspective, in terms of his role in resisting the Republican agenda currently, I would have likely, if I were him, addressed the situation in a slightly different manner, and I wouldn't have resigned. And I think when we look at Mr. Franken's response by resigning from the Senate and juxtapose that to what's going on right now with Roy Moore, who is an Alabama Republican candidate for, I believe, Senate, where he's been accused of similar things, which, the level of what he's been accused of in terms of seriousness of his acts is far worse than
Let's be specific here. Roy Moore is accused of inappropriate behavior with a 14-year-old female child. This is by far, I would imagine, far worse than the accusations of inappropriate touching, which are still inappropriate, by Mr. Franken. But go on.
Yeah, so with Roy Moore, you're dealing with, granted, the accusations are old. However, you're dealing with an accusation of what's essentially statutory rape. And Mr. Moore and his campaign team's response to these allegations has been to not back down, not to admit any wrongdoing, and to continue to press for the success of his campaign. Now, I don't think that Al Franken should have necessarily done that. However, when you consider the very delicate political balance or imbalance that you see in the legislature right now, honestly, the accusations and what I see as infighting amongst the Democrats only serves to hinder their policy goals, which ultimately are more important. We have a, quote, tax reform proposal that ultimately injures the middle class. We have proposals to eliminate income-based student loan repayment and forgiveness for graduates and so on. I mean, these are massive policy issues the GOP is pushing in Congress right now, and compared to relatively minor accusations, I honestly think that if the party were cohesive and, you know, the supporters of Mr. Franken were being strategic, they'd say, well, we take these accusations seriously, but Mr. Franken has very important work to be doing right now, and we will address these in due course.
Let's talk about the strategy here. What I see coming down the pipe in Minnesota is a very strong possibility of a Republican victory for this otherwise safe Democratic seat. If we look at the likely contender for this newly freed Senate position, we are looking at former Governor Tim Pawlenty, a Republican who is plenty popular in Minnesota. This would even further tip the balance towards the Republicans. And you have to remember, even if there was a tie currently, the vice president of the Senate is the vice president who is Mike Pence, and would cast the tie-breaking vote. So already the Democrats are at a disadvantage. This will push them into a further disadvantage, one that they could not even hope to stop the Republicans from steamrolling any process. So I would agree. This is a disaster. It is disturbing that one party, at the mere hint of sexual impropriety, is expected to have its candidates resign, while another party can support people who openly call for groping women's genitalia, who are, clearly have accusations of pedophilia in their background. This is a disturbing revelation, to say the least. Let's do a quick fire round. I will ask one question. I want a yes or no from each of the panelists. The question will be, should Al Franken have resigned? Dr. Thomas?
No.
Pamela?
No.
Craig?
No.
Sarah?
No.
No is correct. Issue two. The rise of the alt-right. Sarah?
Yes?
You and I were covering the alt-right rally in Portland.
That's right.
On September 9th. This alt-right rally was put on by the so-called Patriot Prayer group. And we covered the counter-protest, which was, how would you describe the size of the Patriot Prayer group, Sarah?
Well, it was very small. You know, you had one guy.
Exactly, one guy. Right. Well, maybe there was an allied fellow walking around.
He had a buddy, yes.
A buddy. There were two people, let's be clear. It was a rather anemic show by the Patriot Prayer Group in, what was it, Freedom Park, I believe is what downtown Portland is. And to meet this group of, as you said, two individuals, we had a cadre of... I'd say close to 700 to 800 counter-protesters, many of which were members of the, left-leaning group, Antifa, some of whom were peaceful Buddhist protesters, a number of whom were veterans against racism. Now, Sarah, we had a chance to interview both the Veterans Against Racism folks, the gals with the signs that we interviewed briefly. We had a chance to interview the peaceful Buddhist protesters. Now, what did you make of the Buddhist response to this alt-right rally? And can you describe a little bit about our interaction?
That particular thing. It was very calm and mellow, and it was actually pretty opposite of the more aggressive instigators, I guess you could say.
Yeah, and they were aggressive. The Antifa groups were itching for a fight. In fact, you remember that the fella who the police rounded up. Maybe you could tell him.
The guy that had the bat in his backpack.
Bat.
Yes, a bat. It was a smaller bat, but, you know.
Yeah.
You bat can't, nonetheless.
Yeah, this is a,
bring weapons to,
Right. This is a member of the so-called Antifa group. Sarah and I, in our course for covering this for KKRN, observed that a number of police had surrounded a member of this Antifa group, clad in black, who had gloves with metal bearings along the knuckles. The police opened his bag. Inside the bag was what Sarah would describe as a bat. I think the proper term is a blackjack. This is a smaller bat used to attack. And the police asked if he wanted to leave or if they wanted him to confiscate his property. And he allowed them to confiscate the property. He would not reveal his name, though they made him take off his bandana and mask. Now, this is just a little bit of background. The Buddhist protesters, numbering about 20 or 30, were sitting quietly protest this alt-right group, Patriot Prayer. The Veterans Against Racism, they had signs and were walking around peacefully to protest the alt-right presence. But Antifa were actively yelling at these two alt-right fellows, calling them, every pejorative name and, getting others.
Trying to get a reaction.
Yeah. I think it was.
That's all it was. Yeah.
It was. It was classic trolling, yeah. Trying to get them to say something when, in effect, I think the alt-right were trying to instigate exactly what this violent Antifa group.
They were just feeding off of each other.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. And it was a show. Yeah. It was a show for the media. It was a show for us and radio. And it made both groups look rather ridiculous. I would have rather spent the entire time covering the peaceful Buddhist protesters rather than the hodgepodge of extremists on either end. When you enter into a violent confrontation, you are in the wrong. You are in the wrong. And provoking others into violence is also repugnant. We had witnessed, would you describe him as a fellow, mentally, how would you describe the fellow?
I would say almost, mentally challenged in some way, yeah. And then you had these Antifas that were trying to use him as a tool to get a reaction out of these two alt-right guys.
They were goading a fellow with obvious mental challenges to say, nasty things, to try to get, the alt-right to say something about his disability or to yell at him back. And it didn't work. It just made them look like as ridiculous as you might imagine. Now, I've said time and time again, the proper way to deal with trolls is not to feed trolls. And we notice this with other groups as well. Let's take Fred Phelps and the Westboro Baptist Church. This is a repugnant church that goes from military funeral to military funeral, protesting the dead, leaving signs that say very pejorative things against gay people. I'll use their exact wording. They say have signs that read, quote, "God hates fags," using a pejorative against homosexuals. They are repugnant. They tell people that the reason their son or daughter is dead is because the U.S. government allows for the recruitment of gay soldiers with the Do Not Ask, Do Not Tell policy. They're trying to get a reaction. If you don't give them a reaction or the reaction that they want, if you meet their speech with counter speech, you've already won. You already won. So, quick fire round. Should you meet the alt-right with violence? Dr. Thomas.
I think you should just tell them to grow up and get out of their mother's basement.
That's right.
Correct. Pamela.
Not violence.
Craig.
No violence.
Sarah.
No violence ever.
Those are all correct.
We're so good.
We are. Issue three. The National Park debacle. This week, Donald Trump has put forward a plan to reduce two national parks, one of which the Bear Ears National Monument, the other Staircase Escalante National Park, by 85% and 50% respectively, selling off the assets to private resource developers. Mr. Trump quoted was quoted as saying the move was to, quote, end abuse and return control to the people. End abuse and return control to the people. What he really means is to return control of the resources. Under half and 85% of these national monuments, national parks, to private interests. Andrew, where do you stand on the privatization of our national parks?
First off, I don't think it's a privatization. And there's a couple of points of clarification that you might not be aware of. So first, it is not the national parks that we're talking about. We're talking about national monuments, which originally under the 1906 Antiquities Act were set aside as limited areas of public interest that deal with either historical, archaeological, or natural phenomena that should be preserved for the public. And in terms of what you would call privatization, it really isn't occurring. What they're doing is they're taking what is a national monument designation and reverting it back to the Bureau of Land Management, which also administers the monuments to begin with, which just allows for more things to occur on that land. Now,
well, wait a minute. Let me talk about that for a second. You're right. The semantics are off. These are monuments, but BLM allows for exploration of resources. They allow for cattle grazing. They allow for a tremendous exploitation of the land. This would have otherwise been protected by the.
David, here's the issue, and when you know you're in Redding, I'm in rural Montana, so I see this
correct
a little bit more closely. The issue in terms of public lands, and you definitely see it in the inland West, where you have vast swaths of federal land. For example, Idaho is roughly 60% federal land. Nevada is almost 90% federal land. The issue here is with regard to political factions, and I think it's something that you have to, getting back to kind of the same question, the political strategy we talked about with Al Franken, you have to realize that for a lot of rural communities in the inland West, they're dependent upon either timber or extractive industry, so on. And unfortunately, you know, when you look at political divisiveness as it's been occurring, unfortunately, there's been a schism in the left between, you know, the traditional kind of blue-collar working Democrats who you know, historically would favor those types of industries and environmental conservationists. And really,
which is let's be clear. This is also the split between Dr. David Pearl and Dr. Andrew Thomas at this point as well.
true.
Right. Go on.
And here's the issue: is that in terms of political pandering, I think that you know on some level the move to limit the national monuments makes sense from a land management perspective because. You know, conservationists, ideally, or at least some of them, the more radical elements, would want to turn literally everything into a no-access-granted, no-use wilderness. Economically speaking, and also in terms of long-term conservation, that's not feasible. You have to have good management practices. And I think, you know, the right has exploited this issue and retooled it into one of, oh, well, they're keeping the public off of lands they already own. They're depriving people of their right to use, which then...
And by people, we mean corporations. Now, where I would agree...
It creates an inroad, though, for these highly destructive, highly extractive industries.
Here is where I want to differentiate. There's a large difference between grazing rights, something innocuous that you know, rural communities could use, in these monument territories, park territories, BLM land, and you know high-intensity mining that might leave behind a Superfund cleanup site. Now, I mean, let's take where you are. I mean, you are in rural Montana. I am here in rural Northern California, and both areas have their share of Superfund cleanup, mining residue left that leaves a lifeless body. In Montana, in Butte, I'd imagine there are such places, right? I mean, we're talking about...
Oh, yeah, it's called the Berkeley Pit, which is the largest Superfund site anywhere in the United States. I think, David, if you'll bear with me for a minute, this will clarify it. I think that in terms of strategy for the left, in terms of getting ownership of this issue in a way that's less divisive, again, if there's an understanding of mixed use of land, proper management and mitigation, it would probably garner far more political traction and capital, especially in the rural West, than merely saying, well, you know, by permitting grazing, you're warranting the destruction of land, or by permitting mining, you know, with mitigation and with modern techniques, i.e. things that you don't see with, let's say, the Berkeley Pit in Butte, Montana, that, you know, this is something that's feasible. And ultimately, with this issue, you know, you look at it and you have to kind of see both sides. And I think ultimately what's happening, and it's the same thing with the Al Franken, Roy Moore contrast, is the GOP is capitalizing upon staunch rhetoric, rigid viewpoints, and exploiting it successfully. And I think that the Democratic response would be to say, well, we favor national monuments, but we also favor enlightened, environmentally sensitive land management, and we favor supporting those communities that depend upon such things.
Mm. Andrew, we're going to take a quick break for station identification, then we will come back and finish our discussion. KKRN is a community and listener-supported radio station. We are all volunteer at KKRN, 88.5 FM. You're listening to Pearl on Politics with Dr. David Pearl.
And I have a question. And is that okay that I asked
you
Professor Thomas? One of the key words that you used, that you used right before we had our station identification, was an enlightened policy. Mm. And that would be wonderful depending on who is running the Department of Interior, the Bureau of Land Management, and so forth. And Zinke is not, in my opinion, a friend of enlightened policies concerning how we use land. And, you know, even grazing rights, we know that cattle can destroy stream areas. The natural habitat of wolves and grizzlies are killed so they can have the cattle, you know, that are grazing in these areas. I mean, all of this it can be problematic, but it seems like underlying this is this hunt for extraction to take as many minerals and resources as we can, and then if you don't like it, not you, but if people don't like that, then these large corporations come in and sue. Like energy transfer and logging companies out of Canada, so it becomes very problematic to protect land.
Yeah, and again, I think that when you look at the policy debates surrounding land use, especially in the West, not just natural resources land, but also development issues, when you look at what's occurred, especially in the past 30 years, You're 100% correct in that there are best practices, and typically, let's look at forestry. Most high burn areas, if you read the literature, it says that some forestry is generally good at mitigating fires. Clear cutting really doesn't work very well, and also just leaving it completely alone doesn't work very well. And unfortunately, this is, and I think that this is due to economic interests, but also just ideologies of both sides, there's the stubbornness of interest groups, either, you know, let's say the mining or logging industry, but also, you know, certain environmentalist groups to not recognize that, you know, ultimately this is an issue of compromise, and that when, you know, you look at how people use the land, how people integrate with it, how nature exists in the modern world, you know, neither side, and I think that there are some good people that are compromising at it, especially in terms of researchers, neither side has a monopoly on the argument, and that ultimately it's an issue of compromise. And I agree. And unfortunately, when you look at policy issues in general, not just, let's say, land use issues, but economic issues, social issues, you know, it's the same bifurcation of views and rigidity in terms of ideology that ultimately isn't pragmatic, and ultimately everyone loses at the end of the day because people aren't willing to step back and say, well, you know, I'm not going to, let's say, for instance, preserve all rural lands, or I'm not going to be able to utilize all mineral resources or whatever. And, you know, again, I think that that's just indicative of the polarization of American politics.
Well, a couple things. You mentioned the use of, quote, best practices, the use of, quote, modern techniques. I have yet to see some of these industries, particularly mining, particularly oil extraction. You know, I'm always hearing about the most modern techniques. And then what do I hear the next month? There's an oil spill over some portion of the Dakotas. We are not talking about a foolproof system. No engineering system is foolproof. These are accidents waiting to happen. Grazing, forestry, very different from mining and heavy resource extraction. Pamela, I'll give you the last word here.
Well, I just wanted to make a comment about compromise, because as I understand it in North Dakota, one stat that I saw was between 2 and 4% was the unemployment rate, because everybody's focused on, or most everybody's focused on, the mining, the coal, the fracking. Now, the native populations, this goes back to compromise, is saying that every waterway, every reservoir is contaminated and polluted. So I'm wondering how compromise plays into this when we are destroying what we need to survive, water. And, you know, do we compromise to say, oh, it's okay if 50% of the water is polluted and toxified? Or do we just say, no more, let's go to green energy. All those jobs, or many jobs, can be picked up through green energy. That would be... And I don't see that as a radical, necessarily a radical position, that we need water to survive.
Dr. Thomas, I will give you the double last word, then we'll move to Craig and Sarah. Where do you stand on this, the use of green energy over the, Pamela referred to the Standing Rock movement, the movement against the pollution of the Dakota's water supply by native populations?
Well, I think in that instance, when you look at the use of non-renewable energy resources, and I'm, you know, closely related with a lot of people who work in the petroleum industry and the mineral industry, there's a tacit realization that regardless of their current economic interests, that inevitably that conversion will occur. And the issue with that, much like the issue of technological revolutions in the past, is It's a very easy thing to propose, much like compromise is an easy thing to propose, or conservation or extraction is an easy thing to propose. Same thing with any human endeavor. The question is how does it get implemented? How does that transition occur in definite, finite steps that are tangible and have an actual impact on society? And ultimately, I think that everyone realizes that will inevitably occur, especially with energy. The question is how long will it take? How much are we going to invest in it? How long will certain economic interests remain? And, you know, as with a lot of things, sometimes the transitions are very quick. Other times they take quite a while. I think with energy, you know, the ball is already rolling with that, and you know, it's just a question of you know, implementing step-by-step procedures to stop using non-renewable energy resources, but also to engage in environmental mitigation and other things, which in the instance of water pollution with fossil fuels is something that can be completely avoided.
Correct.
Other environmental issues, I think it's more of a balancing act, because we have to use those resources. And again, it's an issue of proper management.
Well, let's take solar cells before we go to break. The rare earth minerals that are required for solar production are devastating to the environments where they are dug from the ground. We are effectively paying Peter to pay Paul. Is that the colloquialism?
Robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Well, one or the other. I think we're paying somebody there. But no. You're right. You're right.
Along those lines.
Along those lines. Along those lines. Craig and Sarah, do you have any thoughts?
Well, I think that, you know, it's very windy in the Dakotas and such as that, and you could put a lot of wind farms out there, and it would work just fine, provide a lot. There's quite a bit of sun as well. We don't need to continue fracking, coal mining, any of that. And also, with regards to the grazing rights, it was interesting to me that the Bundys aren't even willing to compensate the taxpayer for their grazing rights. They have over $1 million and they're owing to the American taxpayer, and they think they have the right to do this without any compensation to the rest of us? I don't think so.
Let's be clear. We will touch on the Bundys in future programs. They require quite a bit more time. We are close to the segment break. Sarah, real quick, lightning round, rob Peter or pay Paul?
Rob Peter.
Correct. We are moving into our music break. We're going to take a quick music break, come back with station identification and more of Pearl on Politics.
I had a dream the other night. Now, in my dream, our national bird had become the ostrich. How much can she take? How much can she give? How much is too much, and how much longer can she live? As we turn our backs and turn our eyes and pretend we don't see, if ignorance is bliss, then full of bliss are we. As we take, 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 like a good mother, Mother Nature keeps giving, but her heart must be ready to break. She's being abused and overused by her children who choose to ignore. There's only so much that she can give before she can give no more. Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrows will depend on what we do today. Let me not greed lead the way. We poison the air, we poison the land, and we poison the water we drink. And we're the only known creatures in the whole universe with the ability to think. But we keep on thinking, happiness lies in how much we buy and sell. And more of paradise is lost, and only time will tell what will become of Mother Nature in the coming years, when we will have about 10 billion neighbors on this sphere. Will our children's children wake up to the American dream? Or will it have become a nightmare beyond imagining? Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrows will depend on what we do today. Let me not greed lead the way. So much and waste so much, how much do we really need? And how long can a dream survive that seems to thrive on greed? A little pollution is so thick and dark and dense, it contaminates and poisons common good and common sense. Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrows will depend.
And we're back. We are back with Pamela Spoto, Craig Boyer, Sarah Williford, and via telephone, Dr. Andrew Thomas. Andrew, are you still with us via telephone?
Yes, I am.
Okay, fantastic. This is KKRN, a community and listener-supported radio station. We are all volunteers at KKRN 88.5 FM. You are listening to Pearl on Politics. I am your host, Dr. David Pearl. Issue four, North Korea miscalculation. This week, Donald Trump announced that he was moving U.S. fighter jets in theater to South Korea to participate in a, quote, war games with the South Korean military. Currently, there are over 500 jets involved in this particular war game, including the U.S.'s, well, our most advanced fighter jets, the Lockheed Martin F-22 and Lockheed Martin F-35, both stealth jets, presumably capable of entering North Korean airspace without North Korean detection. This worries me. This is a unpredictable regime, a nuclear-capable regime, a regime that has recently tested nuclear weapons capable of reaching the United States, though weapons without the kind of guidance systems that modern nuclear powers have. Still, it is fairly clear that Kim Jong-un, the despotic leader of North Korea, could at his leisure call for the destruction of Seoul, South Korea, possibly target and accurately target portions of Japan. Is this a poor move, a provocative move? We'll start with Craig. Craig, is this a provocative move on the part of the U.S.?
It most certainly is. We sound a little bit like North Korea, and and we have a loose cannon in the White House right now, and just as they have a loose cannon over there.
Yeah. Sarah, what do you think? Provocative move?
I don't know. I don't want
to. Don't want to speculate.
I kind of came in.
Oh, yeah. And to let you know, Sarah was in and out, and we are now live. Pamela, is this a provocative move on the part of the U.S.?
Yes, it is. And there's so much to be said about this, and I know I don't have a lot of time to say it.
No.
But if we look at the history of North Korea, too, I mean, their country was leveled. And of course, the more provocative the U.S. is, the more they're going to amp it up in North Korea, I would think. All I have to do is look at what happened to Libya, what happened to Iraq, what's happening to Syria.
Yeah.
So this is not the right path.
Yeah. And I think you're right. I think you're right. Dr. Thomas.
It's honestly hard to tell, you know, if it's provocative or defensive considering the dynamic. I think even if it's responsive to North Korea, it's essentially giving in to the bullying of the regime and doing exactly what, you know, their regime wants, which is to provoke Trump, to provoke the administration into responding in a way that, you know, falls just short of war but wastes resources. And again, and I think Pamela is correct, further enrages the people. And you know, I would question, you know, the efficacy of the North Korean regime. It doesn't seem like a place anybody would want to live. However, honestly, I think the best way to deal with North Korea would be to take the position that Nixon did with China, which is to engage them constructively, attempt to push for as much opening as possible in their population, and give them an economic stake in the world economy that would hopefully sequester their, you know, acting out, which is probably the only way to describe what they've been doing.
Instead,
I don't think Trump is willing to do that.
Instead, we have played into their hands. This is we talked about trolling in the alt-right and the kind of response that some people want. This is exactly what the regime would want, a way to entrench its own power. We saw this with Castro in Cuba. We saw this with almost every despotic regime under the sun. Look at how the West treats us. We are the defending the national interest, whatever that national interest is. Let's do a quick lightning round. Should we be provoking North Korea? Dr. Thomas.
If it includes just dropping huge amounts of food and consumer goods on the North Korean people, yes. Otherwise, no.
Pamela.
No.
Craig.
Absolutely not.
Sarah.
No.
Those are all correct. Let's move.
Well, could I ask you, Professor Pearl, a question about this? Because in the recent past, you know, not that many years ago, I mean, South Korea and North Korea wanted to talk. They wanted to start reconciliation. But the U.S. stepped in and doesn't allow that. So it's very problematic about who is provoking whom.
It is a two-way street. Now, there was a joint project between the North and the South. In fact, I think it might have been Samsung or another company had a joint factory with the North along the DMZ in what they called the special industrialized zone, where they were effectively building IC components for Samsung phones, the type that we all enjoy. And that project fell by the wayside after a number of sort of tit-for-tat measures, not just by the U.S., but principally by the U.S., and provoked by North Korean testing of various rockets. First, the so-called Taepodong-3 missile, then the Taepodong-4, and finally their unnamed nuclear two-stage rockets. As you can guess, and as Andrew alluded to, this is not opening up the North Korean economy. This is not giving them a stake in relations with the West, and this is leading to, down a dangerous road, a road that may end in a nuclear oblivion, not for the U.S., because let's be realistic. These are not weapons that can target us very effectively, but definitely for our friends in Asia and for our competitors. The Chinese need to be just as worried as we do, as do third countries, Russia in particular. Their weapons can probably accurately target sites as far north as Vladivostok, though they would likely target our friends and allies in the south. Those seem to be the popular targets.
And nuclear radiation doesn't stay just
on
in
borders.
One area.
No.
Within borders.
No.
So no matter what, we would be receiving some of that air and radiation.
Correct. Final issue. Issue 5. Furious Russia. Furious Russia. And this segment is devoted to L.A. Max. Thank you, Max, for asking us to talk about Russia today. No pun intended. A little bit of background is required. 2 years ago, the Turkish armed forces shot a Russian jet, a Russian fighter jet, out of the air in northern Turkey before it had entered Syrian airspace. The Russians were furious. The Russians contemplated an action of reciprocity, in other words, to shoot down a Turkish plane. They did not. They were furious. They stopped trade with the Turks and Russo-Turkish trade is tremendous. Agricultural products, hard goods. And trade was cut off for the better part of a year. March of that year, the U.S. accused Russia of moving intermediate nuclear weapons into the south of Russia, presumably as a threat to the Turks, to say, look, we have these fast-acting nuclear weapons in theater that could hit your capital or Istanbul at a moment's notice. However, if this occurred, it did violate the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, or the INF. The INF was signed by Mikhail Gorbachev and Ronald Reagan in 1987. It is a treaty that limited the deployment of intermediate nuclear weapons, the idea being the Russians couldn't deploy intermediate nuclear weapons along either the coast of Cuba or a coast, what was the Soviet coast in the modern state of Georgia, along the Abkhaz coast, and that the U.S. couldn't position intermediate nuclear weapons in Turkey. Fast forward to today. Russia is furious. The U.S. Congress passed a $58 million bill to research the modernization of our intermediate-range nuclear weapons, and we have indicated that we will not renew the INF. The Russians are upset. The Russians claim they never did move those intermediate weapons into southern Russia. In other words, moving within their own country military assets as a response to the Turks shooting down a Russian plane in Syria. Well, in any case, I would view this as problematic. Why? Seek to poke the bear, as it were. And I guess there is a pun intended there. But why invest so readily in weapon systems that we don't intend to deploy? We have a ballistic deterrent capable of hitting anywhere on the globe within something like 30 or 40 minutes. Why decrease the time frame to 10 or 15, 5 or 10 for these intermediate weapons? The question to the panel, should we pull out of the INF, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty? We will start in Montana with Dr. Thomas.
No.
Pamela.
No.
Craig.
No.
Sarah.
No, sir.
All correct. All correct.
We're so smart.
We are. We are. I will hand it to us. I think this is a problem. I think this is a disaster waiting to happen. We are dealing with maybe the modernization of our own weapon systems, but our adversaries the world over are still utilizing 1960s and 70s technology without the kind of modern fail-safes. It is a miracle that we have had only a few nuclear disasters up until now. Quite frankly, we are looking at, we might be on the precipice, not of a nuclear disaster in North Korea, but in a nuclear exchange between two competent powers with targeting systems capable of hitting Moscow, Russia, New York, or Washington, D.C. in the U.S. A horrible event in any case. To the panel, any last thoughts?
Well, I have a last question. Well, maybe it's a last question. Mm. How many countries has the U.S. invaded in the last, 12 to 15 years, do you think? Would it be 10, 8, somewhere around there?
In the last 15 years?
Yes.
Going back to 1996, we are looking at invading the sovereign nation of Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia disintegrates, moving into the sovereign nation of Montenegro, of Serbia. Troop deployments in over 110 nations around the globe. The attacks, 5 years before that in Grenada, Panama, the attack on Iraq, covert actions in Pakistan, in Iran with the death of Iranian nuclear scientists,
yes,
that were at the time falsely attributed to the Israelis. The attacks on Iraq in northern Afghanistan, the U.S. involvement in the Philippines against Abu Sayyaf in the south, we are talking about at least 10.
So my point and my second question would be, we're concerned about Russia moving weaponry around their country.
Yes.
And we're moving around the world into other countries. And for example, in Syria, Russia was asked to come in by their sovereign leader. We were not asked to come in.
Indeed.
And so I just don't understand this double standard. I truly don't. How hypocritical. You know, if we weren't doing these things and we said, okay, you know, you're doing that. But if we torture, how can we say other countries shouldn't? Or if we invade all of these countries.
It is the parable of the hypocrite. And in fact, you mentioned that we were not invited into
Syria.
Though one force was quite happy to see us attack the legitimate government of Bashar al-Assad. That was the Islamic State, led by Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. They were quite happy to watch U.S. bombs drop on both Russian special forces and, as it turns out, the legitimate army of Syria, as well as members of the Iranian Quds Force and other special forces and groups that came in from nearby Lebanon. There's kind of a meme that I saw once. I don't know if you've all seen this meme, and it shows a list of NATO bases, and they're surrounding Russia. And the meme at the bottom says, "How dare Russia? They are surrounding our military bases." You know, as if or they're putting their country so close to our military bases, as if it's not the other way around. We are encircling the Russian Federation with military assets. If I were the Russian Federation, I would be extremely worried. I would be extremely worried. The actions in the west of Ukraine, where openly far-right individuals have taken power in a coup d'etat, should strike fear into the heart of the Russian body politics. The actions in the Baltic states, with openly hostile, sometimes Russophobic states, Estonia and Latvia, which don't even allow their Russian ethnic minorities to vote, should alarm the Russian Federation. The U.S. pulling out of the INF should alarm the Russian Federation. And yet we are stuck with this adage that it is all the personality of Vladimir Putin that's to blame. Somehow he's paranoid of the intentions of these, you know, many, you know, groups of affiliated far-right regimes, allied neo-Nazis in Ukraine. I mean, if you were surrounded by, maybe your house gets surrounded by a group of hostile individuals, you might call the police, you might be worried. In other words, the Russians have every right to be upset. Any final thoughts from the panelists? We'll start in Montana. Dr. Thomas.
Yeah, I'd just like to draw the parallel between the North Korea issue and the Russia issue. Unfortunately, when you look at the goals of the United States, the idea of creating stability and harmony seemed to be a second thought. And ultimately, when you look at North Korea, and I think North Korea, you know, is a little bit more culpable than Russia in terms of tipping the balance in one direction or another, but it's really the same thing as Russia. You know, the best way to deal with potential adversaries is engage them and give them a stake in their own prosperity with you.
Agreed.
We did it with the Chinese. We have a very stable relationship with the Chinese. We also did it with the Marshall Plan. I mean, you know, Japan and Germany have been allies of ours now for almost 70 years. It's a very stable arrangement. Everybody's benefited from it. And unfortunately, I think that the political rhetoric of various factions, either with regard to Russia or North Korea, but also the overall mentality, is something that avoids stepping back and considering, you know, the long-term stability that could be created from saying, all right, these individuals are not enemies, let's engage them actively in a way that recognizes their autonomy and gently pushes them in the direction of responsibility, both towards us, but also to their own citizens.
Agreed. Pamela, last thoughts.
I would like to see a lot more cooperation and working and being a good citizen and being a good citizens in the world, you know, and not being hypocritical, but cooperating and working with other countries for the benefit of all. Diversity is great.
Agreed. Craig, final thoughts.
Our government has been very arrogant and controlling of other countries, and we need to stop it.
Agreed. And the last question to Sarah. Sarah, provoke Russia, yes or no?
No.
Correct. Bye-bye.
So we would like to end this program saying that KKRN is a community and listener-supported radio. We are all volunteers at KKRN, and this is 88.5 FM, and you have been listening to Pearl on Politics with Professor David Pearl. Goodbye for now.